From Topps comes the all-new digital card collecting app, free to download from iTunes or Google Play, Star Wars Card Trader.
For the first time ever, collect and trade everything from legendary 1977 Star Wars cards to new cards featuring exclusive content from Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
All from the comfort of your mobile devices, Star Wars Card Trader.
These are the cards you're looking for.
Listening to Coffee with Kenobi, you are, with Dan Z and Corey Club, the podcast you're looking for. This is. Yes.
For an entire generation, people have experienced Star Wars the only way it's been possible, on the TV screen. But if you've only seen it this way, you haven't seen it at all.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
We've been waiting for you.
The Force is strong here, even stronger than the coffee.
At last, where have you been?
Welcome to Coffee with Kenobi. Here are your hosts, Dan Z and Corey Club.
We are thrilled to have another cup of coffee with Lucasfilm's Pablo Hidalgo. He is the author of Star Wars The Force Awakens Visual Dictionary and the updated and expanded Star Wars Character Encyclopedia. Pablo is also creative executive at Lucasfilm and has one of the most cleverly and wonderfully sarcastic accounts you will ever find on Twitter, which we love. Welcome back, Pablo.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And it's always fun to ask you about Star Wars and just kind of see the way you view the world, because it's always insightful and interesting. So we're going to look at the Visual Dictionary first. The book came out in December of last year, of course, and instantly became a runaway hit, as well as an invaluable resource. It's pretty clear that an incredible amount of work went into this. What is the collaborative process like for a book of this nature?
It's a combination and culmination of a lot of different things. Part of the reason I was selected to be the author of it was because I had the inside track on the development of the film, and security was so tight on it that, and the schedules being what they always are, schedules are tight, that they figured that it was easiest just to go with someone who already was invested and embedded into the project, as it were. So in that regard, DK came to me, asked me if I was interested. I said, totally. And I was able to basically compile all this information that I had been collecting over like the last couple of years of the film's production and find a place for it. So this includes, you know, opportunities to talk to the producer, talk to JJ, talk to, like the creature shop, the head of the creature shop, Neil Scanlon, for instance. On a completely unrelated project, I had talked to him extensively about what his thoughts were on all his background aliens that he had created. And then as a result, I had that information at hand when it came to filling out the visual dictionary. So it was a lot of different places like that that basically resulted in the book that you have right now.
Well, it certainly is a wonderful book. And like you said, it's so many packed with so many great details and fun things. And the amount of detail is really staggering. And with the information on characters and droids and aliens of all shapes and sizes, as much of this was uncharted territory, like you said, a lot of it had been created from scratch and whatnot. How much of the visual aspects of these characters inspire their backgrounds?
Oh, very much so. I mean, a lot of it is just taking a look at the character and seeing what, Michael Kaplan's costume design or what the art department brought to the table and seeing what that tells you about the character, what you can sort of glean from them. But in some cases, it's always been a mix. Some characters have ridiculously detailed and well thought out information, like Lorsan Tekka had a lot more information going into him than we see in the movie. And other characters, like the Guavian Death Gang, pretty much are only kind of exist as these surface impression characters. You take a look at them, and they're meant to be intimidating, but there wasn't a lot of detail regarding, you know, what goes into their design. So it was a nice mix of translating things that already existed and getting to be inventive and create new stuff. And in the cases where we were creating new stuff, ultimately we sent all that information past. In this case, we sent it past JJ for his approval. And for the most part, he signed off on everything. He maybe made a couple of name tweaks here and there, but he trusted us to do our job. So
Well, that's a perfect transition to the next question we have. And one of the more unique aspects of Star Wars, I think, is the names of characters, which are not necessarily intuitive to pronounce all the time. What is your creative process for phonetic and linguistic agility in the Star Wars universe?
Usually, for cases where I'm involved with naming something, I try to start with something grounded and then, you know, start modifying it and changing it. And then what I always try to do is I make a list of stuff that I've created before it gets published and see if there's any patterns that I fall into and try to edit those patterns out, you know. I could always tell certain author name, like certain creations from certain authors because they favor certain letters and certain linguistic combinations. And so I try whenever possible to iron that kind of stuff out so that I'm not doing too much of a tell on character names that I may have invented. I wish I could – let me think of an example. For instance, like the example I brought up was Goss Tours, who was the Resistance ground technician. Mm-hmm. They made an action figure of him in Wave 1. And it's like the most ridiculous source of that name is when I took a look at the character, I had a low-res image of the character, so there wasn't a lot of detail to start with. And so the first thing that popped into my mind, oddly enough, were the Doozers from Fraggle Rock. And so I had that in the back of my mind, and I started just brainstorming. Okay, what does that tell me? And the Doozers built glass towers that the Fraggles ate.
That's right.
So the name Glass Towers was basically folded into and rearranged to become Goss Tours. Mm-hmm. And that's where his name comes from. So hopefully if you look at it, it doesn't obviously read like a Fraggle reference, but now I've outed it and probably can't help but see it now.
That's
but
right.
That's sort of the kind of mental gymnastics I go through when it comes to naming background names.
You know, that's a book in itself. I mean, it's like there are books about the Origin Mind Beatles songs. I think you've got something there. And also, it's almost like you've confirmed that Ray is in fact a Doozer. How exciting.
You've read it. You saw it here first.
And it would be also interesting to know, and I'm not sure how much you're privy to share with us, which we completely understand and respect. But when it comes to the naming, especially as an English teacher and as a person who likes to study linguistics anyway, is there a difference between how JJ works with names versus how George Lucas does?
You know, I don't know, honestly. I mean, I'm sure there are because they are different creatives. They are different people. But, you know, to George's credit and to JJ as well, they don't pull the curtain back on their processes, you know. And I'm sure George's has evolved over time. Like, he famously kept a little notebook with him and that he would scribble down name ideas. And, you know, a lot of it was stream of consciousness. And then sometimes it was more deliberate. So whatever process they go through, they kind of keep to themselves, or at least, you know, don't try to pin any one approach to it, at least, you know, not publicly. Like I don't know what goes into their namings. I suspect it's usually just phonetics, and because it's phonetics, you're always going to get individual preferences dictating what a person, comes up with, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, switching gears a little bit here, recently I was fortunate enough to get the updated expanded Star Wars character encyclopedia in the mail, and I opened it up, you know, the package itself, and I think literally it stayed in my hands for maybe a few seconds before my kids snatched it up and were poring over it, and it was just, they were just glossing over these pages and just like, oh, this is so awesome, this is all, and, you know, and each new little aspect was really cool. So, you know, for something like this piece here, while it's still informative, the text is much more succinct. What is your writing process for narrowing down a character's profile while retaining their essence?
It's you know, it's an interesting exercise. One of the things, it's like one of the least romantic parts of writing that people tend not to talk about. Mm. But one of the most essential skills you have to pick up is writing to word count, you know. Books have a reality to them in addition to being all the, you know, inspirational and artistic things that they can be. There's always the mechanical realities of a book has to be X amount of pages and the layout dictates how many words you could fit on a particular page, right? So I've been fortunate in just my background that I've always kind of emphasized being able to fit something into a particular shape, into a particular word count. I don't know what it was. I don't know. It was maybe a combination of my learning writing through journalism and through advertising, where you don't have an unlimited platform to say what you need to say. So as a result, I don't know. I know that this is a skill that's important to have, is being able to say something in 100 words, 30 words, 300 words, like just doing that exercise of getting that information across. It's a good skill to have. And it's like, I think we've all been there. We've all experienced what it's like to read a wiki article where we wish it would get to the point, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Jonathan Wilkins is the one who sort of helped me learn that art, because it is an art. I mean, I have found, and I obviously you have as well, that creating all the text and the things you want to explain for your readers, that's much easier than narrowing down, because it almost becomes like your baby in a way, and it's hard to kind of let some things go, but that's the nature of this medium.
Yeah, and I've been involved in projects, and oddly enough, it's often DK projects, and that's not too surprising, because DK has such a strong visual and such a deliberately designed look to their projects, where word count is one of the most important things to keep track of. So I don't know if you guys ever saw the year by year book that I worked on with Ryder Windham and yes. Daniel Wallace, but that was a perfect example where we had to take news events from the history of Star Wars in the nonfiction sense and come up with varieties of story lengths. You know, there would be a 100-word story, there'd be a 30-word story, there'd be a 75-word story. And you had to mix and match the topics that you were writing with and make the judgment call, like, this feels like a 75-word story. And then you'd have to adhere to that limit to get your point across as to why something was worth, you know, noting in this book, but with only 75 words.
That is daunting. My hat is off to you for that. Literally, I just took it off. Can you explain that? While we're looking over these books, of course, there's a lot of wonderful nuance and detail, and people are having a good time just sort of disseminating what is happening here. But I think one of the things that I keep hearing on our show and on Twitter and in social media and things like that is the relationship between the New Republic and the Resistance, and why there's even a need for a Resistance if the New Republic is there. And you explain it pretty well in the book, but I'm just curious to see if you were giving a lecture right now, how you would explain that to newbies of Star Wars.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it was interesting because, like, as The Force Awakens came together, it became clear where the areas were that the movie would focus on and areas where the movie would not focus on. It was, you know, similar to, in the sense of, like, in a New Hope, it was that story is really about the Luke and the Death Star situation, and the history of the Senate and the Republic and all that stuff is really just dressing. So, you know, we were in the position to take a look at the dressing that was going into the sort of geopolitical backdrop of The Force Awakens and really expand upon it so that future authors and storytellers can pull from it as they needed. So one of the key things that we realized about this moment in time in the Star Wars galaxy is we're now able to look at the New Republic with the benefit of looking back at everything that we learned about the prequels and the Clone Wars, which is something that the authors in the 1990s never really had a chance to draw upon because that stuff wasn't defined. So the notion is, after the Galactic Civil War ended, after the Galactic Empire was effectively defeated, what would compel star systems to join the New Republic after everything that had happened beforehand, especially since the last great war had to deal with separatism? So that ultimately informed us that the New Republic was never as big as the Old Republic was, and it wasn't as big as the Galactic Empire was. It was a fraction of its size. And the big concern of the New Republic was just avoiding another galactic war. So in the sense that the prequel trilogy was about the galaxy militarizing, we thought that a primary concern of Mon Mothma and the architects of the New Republic would be demilitarization. So they would try to get the galaxy back to the Episode I era where there were no huge standing armies. And so as a result, anything that can kind of be seen as saber rattling or militarization was frowned upon. And even though the First Order was known to exist, there existed more of a period of a cold war between the New Republic and the First Order. The Resistance is Leia's independent group that, like, she's the only one who seems to be recognizing the threat that the First Order presents, and she wants to be far more proactive than the New Republic wants to be. So she has to operate at an arm's length distance from what the New Republic politicians want to do. That's a really long answer. That is not succinct.
No, but, that's, you know, great.
This is the kind of stuff that, like, we could really get into and talk for hours and hours. But mm-hmm. you know, the tricky part is a movie is not a place to talk about it.
Right. And you can't help but think that some fans might start to complain that there's more political aspects, which to me was one of the more intriguing parts about the prequels. And what you just said, I'm glad it wasn't succinct, because that makes a lot of sense. And you see some of this in Before the Awakening and the new Leia book that's coming out, which is, you know, has a lot of insights into that. So I very much appreciate that.
Yeah, Bloodlines gets into it quite a bit. And mm-hmm. what's interesting is, like, a lot of this stuff that's coming out in print is stuff that was done in the development of the film, but just didn't surface in the film. So, you know, we take our responsibility in the story group, you know, to help create this shape, this narrative structure, and this sense of reality behind the scenes of the movie. So we love that we have these outlets where we're able to put all this sort of backstory groundwork and give it a place for people who want to dive in.
Exactly. And you know, it's interesting because you talked about writing process, you talked about coming up with new characters and what that all means. But, you know, as writing a publication such as this, it's comes to times where some things might be more difficult than others. And I'd like to know some of the things that were more challenging for you, more intriguing entries that you wrote about.
You know, one of the things I had to tread softly on the backstories regarding Luke and Kylo and what happened to Jedi and all that, because even though we have a definition of what that is, it doesn't serve us to make it concrete now when it's best served coming out in a more, you know, dramatically appropriate story. At the time that this book was written, and this we're talking, I think I had to deliver the manuscript in October when was it? It was early 2015, because it went to print in October. So by the time that was written, Rian Johnson had already started work on episode 8. He was actually already had a screenplay in place. And, you know, even Colin Trevorrow was starting to sketch out ideas for what was coming in the future. But, like, I didn't want to rob them of anything that they needed in their storytelling by making a sentence in the visual dictionary more concrete than it needed to be. So it's always a trick of, you know, implying what's there without exposing it fully so that it could come out in a proper place at a proper time.
Makes sense, because that whole creative process, I think the story group is so great because there is that connectivity. It's very a fascinating process. And as you may have heard, Pablo, it can be a bit of a challenge to please fandom. That might be breaking. But also it can be really rewarding to interact with Star Wars fans. So how do you balance this so beautifully?
I don't know. I think I'm just a born diplomat or something. But a big part of it is you totally recognize that even if someone is upset or if someone is absolutely, you know, tickled by something that comes out, it's all coming from the same place of being super emotionally invested in Star Wars. And as anyone who's doing anything creative, you know, the biggest challenge always is just getting people interested in your work. And we have a blessing in that, you know, we're inheriting Star Wars. We're inheriting this amazing thing that George Lucas created. And so we're the stewards of it. And when you're the stewards of something that people are so emotionally invested in, you're not going to please everyone. But the best you could do is try to communicate that you're coming from the same place that they're coming from. We care about this intensely. And, we're doing what we think is right for Star Wars, what we think is right for the future of Star Wars and the present of Star Wars. And hopefully we could find middle ground and understanding that we're coming from this same place, you know?
Right, and exactly. It's interesting because it's, you know, as I took my kids, my oldest is 10, to The Force Awakens, they're young and they're just gobbling these things up, and just disseminating all this universe. It's so large, and just being welcomed to this by so many different mediums throughout the Star Wars galaxy. And so writing something like this, how does one successfully write a Star Wars book that welcomes these new fans as well as some of the stoic brethren that are among us?
It's a balance. I mean, the trick is, like, especially for something like the Visual Dictionary, like, you know, you could catch yourself wondering, when am I being too insular? When am I seem to be only writing to people that have 40 years of history with this brand? And when am I being inclusive for people that don't have this grounding, right? But a book like the Visual Dictionary is really helpful in that regard, because it has different levels of information. You know, you have your intro paragraphs and your more expository, explanatory paragraphs, where you can, by necessity, you have to be a little bit more general. But then you could get, you know, really inside mm-hmm. with the call outs and the details and that kind of stuff that, you know, I swear, I'm sure there's stuff in here that 90% or more of the audience isn't going to get on the first read. But then, like, I'll see something surface and someone will say, hey, did you make this obscure reference? I'm like, yeah, I did. And I'm really happy you found it. Like, for instance, on the – I think it's in the spread with Ray's tools mm-hmm. that she uses in scavenging. I have this, like – let's see if I can pull it up. I have this reference to the fact that she has – oh, no. It's on the spread of the Starship Graveyard, page 35. I have these tools. They're Ray's tools, and there's a Wessex head bit driver and a Blissex head bit driver, which is my Star Wars way of saying, you know, a Phillips screwdriver or you know. Mm-hmm. And those names are from the old role-playing game, Lyra Wessex and Waelix Blissex, two engineers that were involved in the development of the Star Destroyer projects. And so, you know, I've only heard of one person in the world that caught this, but it makes me happy that they did, because it's just like it's a little secret language that we could use to communicate to each other.
That's fascinating. I love
yeah,
that.
I'm looking at it right now, Dan. Yeah. It's fascinating to read those, hear those stories and hear those background little details. It's so much fun.
Well, I read those and I was thinking, I wonder what's going on here. I mean, sometimes it's kind of fun to be esoteric, but it's like you said, it's kind of a balance between, you know, giving inside information to fans who follow so closely and being pedantic. And kudos to you for how you made that happen.
Well, see, like, that's an example of where that's super inside, but all it is like two labels, right?
Right.
And two labels shouldn't, like, two labels shouldn't take you out of a book and think, like, oh, this isn't for me. I don't understand any of this, right?
Right. Yeah. And you can still embrace it whether you get that or not. And so mm-hmm. it's a great thing. So now we have a cool opportunity, Corey, because we get to sit here at the foot of the master and find out some explanations to some Star Wars questions that people have asked us about the mythology. So, for starters, Pablo, the C-3PO one-shot explained how he got his red arm, and perhaps more importantly, at least for me, it delves into some more philosophical aspects of what it means to be a droid, which I don't think has ever really been explored, to my knowledge. So what is the past for 3PO? It's a bit hazy for us as well as for him.
It's interesting, too, because we've talked about this quite a bit, about 3PO's memories. And whether or not they're gone for good or whether or not he has any fragments of them, right? And part of us, like, one thing we always want to preserve is the notion that Bail Organa and, you know, by extension, Captain Antilles took completely serious their task of wiping 3PO's memory, because that was super important, right? We didn't want to suggest that Bail was sloppy in what task he had to undertake. So we do think they did a good job of wiping out this memory. But the notion that even if you do that, there might be fragments, depending on how well developed the droid was at the time that their memory was wiped, was just too irresistible. And, you know, it's like if you give 3PO just enough information, will that come back to him? There was a line in the Clone Wars where 3PO talks about some of his past roles, which suggested that he has some fragments of memories from before his time of being with Anakin, because we're of the belief that Anakin didn't build 3PO from scratch. He cobbled him together from what he found at Watto's junkyard, and that includes a cognitive module that was older than, you know, just older than the time that he was constructed. So there was a very, very early notion in the old expanded universe that 3PO was like 114 years old, and we kind of like that. I mean, I like that notion that somewhere deep inside those memory core, there's the older adventures of 3PO that sometimes surface, you know?
It's not unlike when you delete a file on a hard drive. I'm sure you heard that before, that comparison. But I like that there's verisimilitude in this in every legitimate sense of the word.
Mm-hmm. And it's tricky with droids because it's like – the I've always said that the droid characters in Star Wars are some of the most human characters, right? They're the most expressive, yeah. And they carry their emotions really externally. But at the same time, like, you know, you can go really deep and philosophical in their exploration of it. It's just finding the right story for that kind of thing, because you don't want to take Star Wars into a place where, you know, it gets into the deep philosophical science fiction. But I think the 3PO one shot did a good job of it, of presenting it in the framework of an sort of an adventurous story, and but touching on it in just the right way to be thought provoking.
Well, speaking of memories, and you spoke about, you know, the human nature of droids and such. This is kind of in reference to the conversation that Luke on Endor had with Leia, and it's maybe around the idea of memories and visions, and the question is kind of, how can Leia remember her real mother?
Right. Well, you know, part of me wants to say the Force plays a role, but that does seem like a bit of a cop out. But I do think that's true.
Sure.
The other thing I think is true, and don't go taking this as canon because we haven't seen this in a story yet. This is just my personal theory, and maybe it'll inform a story in the future. Maybe it won't. But I don't think Bail, it's not a secret that Leia is adopted. Leia knows she's adopted. And I could totally imagine it that Bail talked to Leia about what he knew of, you know, Leia's mother. He may never have said, and I don't think he ever said, that it was Amidala, but he could have said that she was a kind woman and that she had, you know, moments of sadness and kindness. And all these kinds of things he could have told her that informed Leia to have a mental image of who this person could be like. And so I think that Leia did carry with her a mental picture of what her mother could be like in much the same way. And this is probably going to get me in trouble because this sounds like speculation, but whatever. In much the same way, it feels like Rey is carrying a picture in her mind of what her parents are like, even though she doesn't know them.
I totally. And it's not unlike, you know, as human beings, as you're growing up, you have memories. And then as you get older, you kind of think about, well, did I actually remember this, or did my parents tell me so much? It sort of became I sort of incorporated that into the zeitgeist of my existence. So that makes sense.
And bringing it back to Star Wars, there's so many people out there who swear up and down that they saw the Biggs footage early screening or on TV, and it's like, no, it never was incorporated into a cut of Star Wars that was ever publicly released.
Well, I remember reading the Star Wars storybook, which was just wonderful. And when I saw that scene, I remember as a little kid thinking, was that in the movie? What's going on? You know, and there was no internet, of course, at that time.
Yeah, so memory plays an interesting trick on people, you know.
It really does. So, and many fans are fond of saying, and this is always, I've always sort of disagreed with this, but I'm curious to see what you think. People are fond of saying that the Sith always tell the truth. But conversely, people said Obi-Wan lies to Luke in A New Hope. For you, what is truth in the Star Wars universe?
You know, it's funny. It's to me, it feels like that is one of Palpatine's tactics, is that he will, rather than feed you an all-out lie, he will use the truth to bend you to his will. But I would be super hesitant to say, you know, that it's a rule, right? That Palpatine will always tell the truth and Obi-Wan will always tell a lie.
Agreed.
Yeah, I think it's more a matter of us recognizing certain patterns, and patterns that come out of people's characterizations. But the idea of making it a hard and fast rule of characterization, I think, is taking that pattern too far.
And you can almost guarantee a lot of people are thinking, well, only Sith deal in absolutes.
Of course, right. Which itself sounds like an absolute statement.
That's
so.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, one of the bigger questions I think Dan and I've talked throughout the years of doing our podcast and such, and just in conversation with ourselves, is the Jedi Order and how that plays a role in their lives, and maybe explain a little bit behind what you kind of your personal feelings and such as far as explaining the paradox of attachment with compassion on some of those levels.
It's a tricky road to manage. I mean. There's something about – I mean, the compassion is just the compassion for life in general, and the empathy and making people like understanding what would be difficult and what would cause someone suffering and doing what you can to alleviate that. But the attachment, you know, it's like – I think a lot of – that word is misunderstood, And to me, this is just my interpretation, attachment really comes down to that sense of ownership and that sense of entitlement to someone else in your life. And that's like Anakin's big slippery fall. I've had this conversation, and I've had people who really love the relationship between Anakin and Padme get upset at me for bringing this up. But to me, it's like, I don't think Anakin, Anakin didn't love her for her. He loved her for the pleasure that her presence brought to him. And it was kind of in this selfish kind of way. I mean, there's a line in episode two when he's, brooding at the lake house, and he's obviously, the recent nightmare with his mother is on his mind. And I think he says to Padme, "Your presence is soothing," right? And to me, that line has a lot to it. It's like, it's not, look at her as a person as opposed to "you bring me this," And the second that Padme's independence and Padme's different point of view becomes inconvenient for Anakin, becomes difficult for Anakin, he becomes difficult to her, as opposed to being more compassionate and listening to what her point of view might be, right? So, and at its worst extreme, it's like, that confrontation of Mustafar where he basically, throttles her with the Force. It's like, he won't listen to her because she's no longer fitting into his plan. And I always thought that the Clone Wars episode with Rush Clovis did such a great job at illustrating how immature and how dangerous their relationship was, right? These were people, both Anakin and Padme, they were emphasized to be intellectually mature, but never had, and I think this was deliberate, they never had the emotional maturity because they were both rushed into the situations when they were quite young. So Padme, being a statesperson at that young age, never had a chance to mature in the sort of emotional sense that comes out of interacting with people. And neither did Anakin, because he was placed in the Jedi Order in the way that he was. So their relationship is a very teenage relationship when they should be older at that point, but they never had a chance to get beyond that point.
Right. They're placed in very unique situations that they're not able to sort of develop their emotional intelligence. And I totally agree with you. And I think the Clovis arc was so essential in kind of forming that, because really, I think sometimes when people think about attachment, sometimes that's almost synonymous with obsession, as you mentioned. And I think Yoda gets it, because he's able to sit back and say, kind of be, as I'll quote Frey Prinze Jr., be like water, let everything kind of flow and don't get so attached to everything, because this is all very temporary. And it's a beautiful part of Star Wars. One of the things I love so much is the ambiguity that is present here. And that involves people being able to have great conversations like this.
Yeah, and one other thing to add to that, like I'll feel a lot of people say, well, it was Luke's attachment to his father that allowed him to succeed when others thought he would fail. But I wouldn't use the word attachment in that regard. Mm-hmm. I would use other words, but just not attachment. But again, that's just my take. And to me, it's like, as you said, it's more powerful for it not to be defined, because to define it too hardly, to define it too firmly, would again, rob us from having this conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's for Luke, it's more like it's compassion, which is sincere.
That's exactly it.
And it's more about the other than the individual, which is, again, Anakin's fall.
Yeah.
So this is sort of off the topic a little bit, but so you work so hard and Star Wars is something that's so fundamental to, professionally and you as a fan, which I think is so great. So how amazing is it for you to go see Star Wars The Force Awakens for the first time? And to see your name in the credits? Are you kidding?
I got to say, that was a surprise. Like, we didn't know. That was my first time seeing the credits. And at the premiere, when it premiered that week, I think it was like the Monday before the big worldwide release, we got to the premiere in L.A. And, I figured there's a possibility, but like, who knows, especially because what we do right now is so not a standardized thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if it's not a standardized role in production. So, all bets are off as to whether or not you get credit or not. Like, I didn't know. I don't know what the precedence was. So I was very grateful to be credited in that capacity. I wish the whole team was, because all of us contributed. But at the same time, you know, I'm super grateful that I was.
Well, how often do you get to be surprised by Star Wars, you know?
True.
Yeah, just sitting here talking to you, Pablo, is such a wonderful conversation, and all the great work you've done. It definitely, it goes to show how much you're followed and friended and just talked about as far as conversations and coming out with these wonderful ideas. I'm sitting here thinking, like, you know, it could definitely be a Rogue One visual dictionary coming out in that essence of that. And I just, I think about that concept of maybe some of your thoughts on that, seeing that teaser trailer. When some of the aspects we've seen so far, and maybe how that's different compared to writing a volume of that sort compared to what you've written in the past.
Rogue One is interesting because it, as we know, it fits. It has to fit more into the Star Wars that we know. Like, there's not this gulf of 30 years where there's a lot of stuff to kind of extrapolate and fit in here. But at the same time, you know, we're really emphasizing the notion of the standalone films, that they do stand alone, that they're not meant to be these hard connections to the Skywalker saga. It's an opportunity to kind of shine a light on characters we've never seen before. So it's this great opportunity to fill in their backstories too. And, you know, the wonderful thing about it is, in the case of Rogue One, you know, starting with the story ideas that came from John Knoll and then were later developed by Gary Whitta and Chris Weitz, you know, a lot of work has gone into developing these characters. And we'll see what we see in the film, but it's really all these characters, they have deep, deep backgrounds. And so I'm hoping to be involved in projects that could further bring those backgrounds up.
That would be neat, and would definitely be one of the first in line to snag it, which would be, you know, anything Star Wars comes out, we're just pouring over it. And real quick before we let you go, it's been a real joy to spend some time with you and over a cup of coffee. I'd need a refill. You doing okay?
I'm doing all right.
Good. Well, I want to talk real quick about Rebels Recon. And that show, I mean, to me, that's as much fun as watching the episodes sometimes. And mostly it's the banter between you and Andy. And the questions are fun, but it's almost like you've taken on like this persona of Pablo versus the real Pablo. It's like you're a character.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm a character with like props and business now.
So what, like, is that something where you just sort of improv, or is that very much like a vision they have for that little series?
It's a combination. I mean, you know, Andy does an amazing job, and behind the scenes, we've got folks like John Harper who shoots it, and Scott Bromley is very closely involved in developing what the sort of bits are going to be in the show and what the what the spirit of the show is like. But to be honest, it's like it's not as if there's a Rebels Recon show Bible that we follow that describes what the character of Andy is and what the character of me is. The coffee gag just completely happened organically when we started realizing, like, I always had a cup of coffee, and it wasn't something that we dictated, but by the time we did, like, I don't know, three or four of them and realized fans were reacting to it, it's like, let's just run with it, let's do this, right? Let's just make it a bit. And honestly, it tends to be a lot of fun. Like, we set aside a little time each week for Andy to quite literally, like, you know, hey, where are we going to shoot this week? Let's do it here. Let's do this real quick. And it's all done very quick. And there is a degree of improv to it. But we love the fact that people have really latched onto it. Like the bit where I was on the cruise ship,
yes,
was that was like just it was like two emails. It's like, hey, I know, let's do this. And they're like, yeah, let's do it. And then, like, I just shot that bit on my iPad and put it, you know, sent it to Andy and the team, and they shot their version on their side of the conversation, and, you know, pretended that it was a live conversation. It totally wasn't, but it was a fun idea, and we just ran with it. So I love that we have a place to do that kind of stuff. And the StarWars.com team are making the most of it, and I know they have more things like that in the works.
I love it. I prefer to think that every time you had a cup of coffee, we just pretend like it's an Easter egg nod to us.
Yeah, right.
And when I toured Lucasfilm last summer, Scott is quite a character. He's very fun. But he and I had a little bit of a contest. He talked like Skeletor and I talked like Mickey Mouse, and that was entertaining.
Well, the funny thing is, like, I hope people don't think that I'm completely annoyed by Andy every time I see her. It's like, no, this is all – we get along just fine. She's not actually interrupting me. But it makes for fun videos, you know.
Absolutely. And you know, we've had so much fun with you today, Pablo. Thank you very much for coming on. And any folks who are out there looking good to reach out and just want to ask you a question or just say hello, how can they get in touch?
Well, like I said, like you said, I'm on Twitter. Handle is just my name, at Pablo Hidalgo. So I'm pretty good at fielding whatever I can when I can actually give an answer. So, you know, I'm there probably more than I should be, but that's the easiest place to get a hold of me.
Well, it's like you've got the patience of a saint, but the wit of Mark Twain.
There you go.
Pretty high compliment.
That's good. Yeah.
That's a very high compliment. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, Pablo, again, thank you so much for having a cup of coffee with us, and feel free to come back on anytime. We'd love to have you.
All right. You guys take care.
Chewie, get us out of here!
If you would like to respond to our question of the show, have a comment, or just want to say hello, send us an email or MP3 at feedback@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or if you have a specific question or comment for either of us individually, email us at danz@coffeewithkenobi.com or coreyc@coffeewithkenobi.com, or visit us at coffeewithkenobi.com and click on the Contact Us section or comment on one of the stories featured on the site. If you enjoy the show, please write a review in iTunes or Stitcher. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/coffeewithkenobi, as well as keep up to date at our Twitter feed at Coffee with Kenobi. You can also find us on Tumblr at coffeewithkenobi.tumblr.com. If you enjoy the jazz music, the album is Eye to Eye by Steve Torak.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
This podcast is not endorsed by the Walt Disney Company or Lucasfilm Limited. It is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com. Star Wars, all names, sounds, and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Disney and their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Coffee with Kenobi unless otherwise indicated.
There's no one here.